My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic. I don't see Clark here, but anybody that took the time out to come and pick me up, and we drove, I think, maybe an hour to get here. So he deserves, there you are, he definitely deserves mention, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate the committee for doing that. Thank you. And Bob did a little talking about why it is that we're here. And I'm assuming, since the room is so full tonight, that there are a couple of other people who, like myself, figure if you're going to be in a 12-step program, why not live the 12 steps? And this particular weekend, I get the opportunity, present company excluded, to, and you guys get the opportunity to hear from some people who've been my mentors in this program, some people who will be able to shed their own experience, some light on their own experiences with these steps. Hopefully when you leave here after the weekend, you'll be able to take something with you. What we have is our combined experiences, and what we have is our opinions, and what we don't have is any authoritative view on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly am going to give you that disclaimer. And I'm going to talk to this evening on steps 1, 2, and 3. And we'll be followed up the rest of the weekend by some people who probably will make a little more sense than you're going to get from this guy tonight. And they're sitting up here. And I just have to say it. I'm the baby of the bunch of this crew, you know, chronologically and in sobriety, you know. One of our members, in fact, is celebrating a birthday, Mr. Anderson. Dick Anderson is celebrating a birthday. And they know I'm not blowing smoke because I know each one of these, the speakers and the presenters this weekend, and they know how I feel about them, and they know what they've done in my life, and they know what they've meant to me. And so if anybody is new in the group tonight, I want to talk to you and I want to welcome you to what it is that you're walking into, this AA way of life. I'm here to talk about steps 1, 2, and 3, and I'm not a step technician. I'm not one who believes more in the ritual than I do in the power. There's a power that exists in these rooms, and there's a power that exists inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have 12 steps that we practice, and if you're anything like me, you wanted to come in and master them. You know, my story involves, you know, I'm a high achiever, I'm a bookworm, I'm a scholar, and I'm a student, and I wanted to attack the program Alcoholics Anonymous just that way, and I wanted to get an A in AA, you know, and and I love it. My friend Bob, who you'll hear from later on tomorrow, he always talks about this being a spiritual condition, and you cannot address a spiritual malady with mechanical means. So I'm not going to talk about, you know, there is no bad way to try to find God, you know, there ain't a wrong way to get to the power. You know, and in fact, you know, these steps that we'll talk about this weekend and this big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which contains our 12 steps, you know, it's a lot of times people ascribe some mystical qualities to the book. And if you're a student of history and the student of history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll know how the book was written, you'll be thinking that these, you know, these roughly 100 men and women were sitting around, and it was this divine intervention, and, you know, it was this big spiritual gathering, and, you know, you just like Moses supposedly had the, you know, the tablets given them, Bill Wilson had it sent to him. Well, imagine a room of drunks just like us, you know, and you imagine some people sitting around, and you know, if it's anybody in there, like, no, my name is going to go in the book. I don't know about Bill Wilson, but you got to put my name on it if I'm going to have any kind. And it was kind of like that kind of activity, you know. So I don't worship the book per se, you know, and it's nothing mystical or magical about the book. In chapter 3, it talks about we tried every imaginable remedy to recover from alcoholism. And it says, here are some of the methods we tried. And it talks about switching from beer to brandy, you know, and it talks about taking a trip, not taking a trip. And it says, reading inspirational books and reading the big book Alcoholics Anonymous without applying the information that's in there in order to have an effective spiritual experience is just reading an inspirational book. just reading an inspirational book. What's this dude talking about? So let's talk about it. Step one is, and I'm here to talk about three steps, and I hope I get an opportunity to do each one of them some service in the time that I'm here. Step one is the problem, and it's for the longest time, and I like the fact that Bob came up here, so I'm going to replow some of the ground, and I'm glad he laid some groundwork. I did a lot of work in before I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and step one is pretty much a conclusion I draw based on my experiences. I'm a late bloomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard a lot of people's stories in here. This is the first place I ever came to where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? And I... My home group at home, I have two home groups, and one of my home groups at home is 9604 South Figueroa. It sits in the middle of South Central Los Angeles, and it's a hard club, and it's a hell of a AA club, and we got some old veterans in there, and I remember being new, and I'd listen to some of the cats sharing, and I'd be like, damn, they got a hell of a story. And I wanted to have a penitentiary story without visiting the penitentiary, Because we had some colorful characters up in there, and they had some colorful stories and the rest. But my story is mine. My story is mine. I'm a late bloomer. I didn't touch a drop of alcohol until I was 16 years old. My father was an alcoholic, and I didn't drink alcoholically at the time I drank it. My father was an alcoholic, and my earliest vow was, I'm not going to be like him. He wasn't the kind of dad that made you proud. He wasn't the kind of dad that was the dad at the little league games. He wasn't the kind of dad that went to the father-son banquets with me. He was a janitor. He disappeared. He drank away from home. He got put out the house when I was 8 or 9 years old. I thought he was weak. I thought he was the man that you weren't proud of. And my brothers and I thought he looked good going when he left my life. So that influence was not an influence that I wanted to emulate. So I said, I'm not going to drink. And I grew up, and I'm a high achiever. I'm a bookworm. And I'm a schoolboy, and I achieved, and I did stuff, and I accomplished stuff, and I got pats on the back. And at 16 years old, I had my first drink of alcohol, and being the shy guy that I was, and being the introvert that I was, and being the guy that I was, that inwardly, I've always, on the outside, I should have been okay. High achiever. Student body president, class president, straight A student, play ball. But on the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And when I drank alcohol, it unleashed me, gave me the power to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it, and I liked it. And it took me on a journey. And I started drinking at 16, not a lot. My drinking took off when I went off to college in 1971. And I started drinking, and my drinking progressed, and alcohol did what it did. I added some other drugs to the mix in the 70s because I'm a kid of the 60s and the 70s. And I grew up, and I love reading the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about me in lots of places. If you're new, there are lots of thin lines in the program that we practice, and surrender to win, some paradoxes. And some of the thin lines make all the difference. When I came around, I came four times. My story is one of relapse and relapse and relapse. And I came four times before I came to stay. And what I used to do in meetings early on in my recovery, I could never find myself in any of you guys' stories, and I couldn't find myself in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the thin lines that makes all the difference is a thin line between comparing and identifying. And I always compared and I never identified. I would always see all the differences in you guys' stories, and I would see the differences in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd read Bill's story. You see, he's an older white guy. First thing I say, we don't have that in common. Bill in his story, was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam era draft dodger. Bill was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. We don't have that in common, Bill, if you read his story a little bit later on, he's got a passage in there that said, there had been no real infidelity. Well, he missed me on that one, too, So I always saw all the differences. Did the same thing when I listened to you guys. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the last time and I came to stay, somebody taught me how to read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they say, Ralph, the same way that you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the same way that you listen to our members share their stories when they get up here at the podium. When you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and when you listen to our members share at meetings, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in the light of those questions, I found my story. When I was at this major university at the front end of my drinking, just like Bill in his story, he talked about the drive for success was on. I'd prove to the world I was important. You know, when I was a kid, I had two goals. One was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. Maury Wills was my idol. Baseball was my game. When it came clear that I wouldn't reach that goal, my second goal, and I meant it with everything in me, I said, I'm going to be the first black president of the United States. And people used to pat me on the head, and people didn't laugh at me. Then I was a high achiever, and I was used to accomplishing. I had the kind of mother that drove us, and she encouraged us. And even though I came from a community, I have, you know, father that wasn't in the house, that wasn't out in my community. We didn't have no money. You know, the first car in my family was the car I bought when I graduated from high school. You know, I come from the heart of Watts. I come from a hard neighborhood, but you wouldn't have known that in my house. I had a high, you know, I had a driving mother, and she was achieving, and she was pushing, and I was an accomplisher. So when I said I'm going to be the first, people patted me on the head, and Bill in his story talked about he imagined himself the head of vast enterprises, and I identified with that kind of grandiosity because I dreamed big, I thought big, and I felt like big things were in store for me. And just like Bill in his story, he said drinks started taking a more important an exhilarating part in his life. And when I was at this major university, I'm rolling with cats who were going to be professional athletes. You were looking at them on Saturdays. We soon be looking at them on Sundays. You know, people who were going to be political leaders in my town, in my state, and in this country. I was looking at people who would later on be captains of industry. And I would be right with them because I was pegged for that, and I was, you know, and I was used to achieving. So I was accustomed to that. So when I started drinking, you couldn't have told me it was going to take me where it took me. Bill had a way of talking that Bill said, from this alloy of drink and speculation, from this combination of his drinking and his thinking, he would later forge a weapon that would turn on him like a boomerang and cut him to ribbons. Don't talk like that. My grandmother used to say, trouble always start out like fun. You know, and that's the way it was for me. Trouble always start out like fun, you know. And so I'm at this spot, man. I'm doing what it is that I do, and I'm drinking, and it starts doing what it is that it does for me. And I didn't notice it at first because my drinking didn't start out. The first drink I had when I was in the back seat of the car when I was 16 years old, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I was with my girlfriend in the back seat. Older partner of mine had his girlfriend in the front seat. I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before. And that's how my drinking started. You know? That's how my drinking started. You know, I would drink to go out on the weekends. I started drinking, and I got to this university, and I started adding stuff to the mix, and things started happening to a guy named Ralph. And we don't have enough time for me to share with you all the things that should have been signs along the way that I was having problems with this deal, alcohol. You know, I ended up married, and I'm the kind of guy, you know. The rest of you guys, I don't know about if the rest of the men in here had any. I always have fears and doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? And do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record gives you answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role to protect and to provide? You know, and it's cold-blooded. You know, I'm the kind of father, I remember sitting on my living room couch, wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up, going to the dining room table, picking her purse up, clutching it real close as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home, sticking the key in the door, 2-year-old daughter sitting here, my wife and her sitting here, and they both crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. You know, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch, 2-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. And I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't ready to be stealing from my wife, and I wasn't ready to be stealing from my daughter. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. My disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. One, it takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But there's another area for me, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more and more readily to chase this thing I discover. First time I went in my wife's purse, if you would hook me up to a polygraph, I would have passed when I told you I'm not stealing this money. I'm taking this $40, and I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing. And I meant it, and I meant it with everything in me. Took that $40, spent it up, came back looking for the purse. She had moved it. I didn't look for it too hard because I couldn't believe I had hit her purse. And I said to myself, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. You know, and the big book has a line that describes, I mean, we don't know why, but the alcoholic will be unable to recall with sufficient force, you know, the memory of the suffering, humiliation of weeks, even days ago. 2 weeks later, same scenario presented. I'm out doing what I do. I came back looking for some money. And the idea of replacing the money didn't even come to mind. I said, last time I took $40 and she moved the purse. This time I'm going to take all the money out and that's it. I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse, right? I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. Did that on a Wednesday, came back one Monday, screen door was locked, the note was on the screen door, suitcase on the porch, the rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. I'm put out of my house, I'm now my daddy. Went to stay at my mom's house. It's a lot of parallels for me in when I read Bill's story. It's amazing what happens when you see, when you can see. Because I can remember in his story when he talked about living at his in-law's house. And he would talk about Lois coming home every day, you know, with a bag. She would have a bag with her every from the department store. My mother came home every single day with a bag of groceries. Because over the course of that next year, my five brothers got put out of their respective homes. And we all ended up at my mom's house and we damn near killed her. And my mother would come home with a bag of groceries every single day. Because if she didn't, these six grown leeches she gave birth to would have cleaned her refrigerator out, you know, feeding people in the neighborhood so we could get what we would get. You know, when I first got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. She used to bring my daughter over on Saturday so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland and I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand, just take her to the store and buy her ice cream. I wanted to sit my girl in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get. To look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I would disappear. I would sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. Still remember some of those long Sunday nights sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. And I see those two heads in the car and the headlights backing out the driveway and I'd be thinking to myself through the tears, there goes my life backing out this driveway. And just like Bob, I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough, I got tired enough, I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. Went to the Harbor Life Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And I found grace on Skid Row. They took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous two days after I was in that program. Speaker was speaking. And he started sharing some things. And he was sharing what I would later find out was in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. He shared that it was something physically different about me. Seemed like he invited me to diagnose myself. Ralph, don't take my word for it. Ask yourself, how many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to just stop off at happy hour after pay? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to stop over here at my boy Dick's house after work for a minute? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979, 1985, whole paycheck. my experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not Bill Wilson, not nobody else in this room. My experience abundantly confirms for me when I take one of anything, no matter what I have to do, where I have to go, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Now, I did not know that, and it made real sense to me first time I read the doctor's opinion, the alcoholics. When I was new, and when I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, it had gotten pretty smart because I'm a smart guy and I get smart when I just let me be around for a little while. You know, I got this. You know, I love when Bob talked about self. I got this. And I would wonder to myself, why we got to go through that book? All we got to do, the 12 steps are on the wall. Why we need the book? It's a 12-step program. Now the steps are what? Why do we need the book? Somebody help me then. What step says we don't take the first one? Somebody will probably say, well, step one, I admit that I'm powerless. Well, I knew I was powerless when I was out there. Kept taking them. What step tells me I don't take the first one? It's not in any of our steps. In the doctor's opinion does some descriptions. And one of the descriptions the doctor's opinion talks about, and it says that we have an allergy. And he says, this idea that we have an allergy interests us. As layman, I ain't a doctor, so I'm not qualified to pass on the medical view of this allergy. But this is the part I like because I'm a practical guy. You guys know I'm not standing up here tonight because I'm the virtuous guy. I'm not standing up here tonight because I'm the good guy. I'm not standing up here tonight because I'm the one that go to church and say, oh, you should believe in God because it's the right thing to do and you're going. I'm not standing here tonight for all of this. I'm a practical guy. And it says, the fact that Dr. Silkworth says that I have an allergy interests us. As laymen, our opinion really don't mean much. I ain't qualified to talk on the doctor. But they said something else. They said, it explained things for which I couldn't otherwise account. It explained things which had been unaccountable for me. Had been unexplainable to me. My old lady used to see me after payday, and I'd show up, man, I'd come home, and I wouldn't have a stamp. I wouldn't have no money. I get paid on Thursday. I stagger in on Sunday. And sometimes she'd be like, dude, how come you can't make it home with a dime out your paycheck? And that wall would come down, and I'd raise up, and I'd get that barrier, and I'd do my, you know, how dare you thing. And behind the wall, I'm thinking to myself, how come I can't make it home with a dime for on payday? And this idea of this allergy, that there's something physically different about me. Now, I don't know if I got a regulator inside me that don't work no more, or I don't know if I was born without a regulator. Really don't matter. There's something physically different about me than other folk. Well, Ralph, how do I know? Look at my experience. Now, I used to think it was something bodily different about me, but I had it backwards. I thought that the reason that I drank so much was because I got high capacity. Yeah, I'm going to tell the rest of you guys, you poop butts, you can't roll with guys like us. Roll with the big dogs. That's why we drink like we drink. You know, I thought that's the reason I did it, because I wanted to and I tried to. Well, what about all them times you overshot the mark? Ralph, be quiet, dude, you know. So it's something physically different about me, and I ain't got to go into some, you know, if you go in treatment centers and the rest, they'll talk about the pleasure centers and the pleasure zone and the, you know, the endorphins and all. I ain't really got to go into all that. Something physically different about me. How you know? Look at your experience. How many times did I say I'm just going to spend 20? Whole paycheck. Do it once. You do it twice. I did it over and over and over and over and over and over again. There's something physically different about me that shows up in my experience. That doctor's opinion is, you know, that chapter in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it is the first place and it's the only place. The doctor says, Ralph, that thing in you that you don't have, we can't grow it in you. We can't put it in you. There's nothing that science has been able to do to give folk like you a regulator that don't have one, or whose regulator is damaged. Now, we got another way of saying it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Once the cucumber becomes the pickle, you ain't going back to the cucumber. You pickle. You know, we can't put that back in you. Dude, so what do I do, Doc? Our only suggestion, and this is in the doctor's opinion. That's why I got to read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have it in our 12 steps on the wall. Our only suggestion is entire abstinence. Nothing. Entire abstinence? Wow, what an order. And so then, okay, how do I know it takes entire? If you hard-headed like me, because I tried it every other way. My experience. The first step is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. And it's the problem. And when I got well grounded, and so when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't do a lot of work on the. Now, I'm not knocking any sponsors that have folk write on the first step. I'm not knocking that. I don't see anything wrong with writing at any point. Write if that's what you do. Do whatever you do. But the first step is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and sit up and ponder and think to myself, I guess I'll decide to be powerless over alcohol. No, alcohol decided that for me. Thank you very much. Old-timers in my home group say, well, we want you when alcohol is through with you. We're not here to try to talk anybody into not drinking. And so I came to that conclusion based on my experience. And when I came to the rooms, I listened to you and you and you and you and you and you tell me alcohol had its way with you and there was no comeback by yourself and it snuffed out the last flicker of hope I could do this by myself. Snuffed out the last flicker of hope I could do it by myself. If it's just my body then, Ralph, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday. Second part of this disease, the mental obsession. The obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered. You know, somewhere in the reading, it'll talk about everything I've talked about up to this point. The difference in the body, that if you suffer from, if you've ever suffered the phenomenon of craving, it only occurs in one class of people, alcoholics. If I have ever suffered the phenomenon of craving, what is the phenomenon of craving, Ralph? That's that allergy I just talked about, that when I take one, I gotta have another. It only happens in folk like us. Now, other folk mirror us. Here's the deal that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous sometime. And I have problems with some of my sponsors because they get, it's a trip, the fervor of the newly converted. When you're newly sober, you see alcoholism everywhere. You know, see it everywhere. They put that bottle down. You don't need to be, you threatening my sobriety. Ain't threatening your sobriety. They doing what they do. Folk drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Normal people like the effect produced by alcohol. It doesn't say in the doc, alcoholics like the effect. Normal people like it. That's why they make alcohol. It does what it does. And guess what? If a normal person drinks and gets behind the wheel, he'll get a DUI too. Because alcohol will impair anybody driving, drunk or normal. So there are people who mirror me that look a lot like me. But they don't suffer from what I suffer from. And the only person who can diagnose me is me. And I look at my experience. That's why they go through the classification of alcoholics. Because it was some cats with my, it was some older dudes who put me down, you know, and they were older than me when I was at school. And a couple of them, you know, they introduced me to all the things I ever got introduced to. And when we got out of school and went into life, my brother and I went to a Super Bowl party at these cats' house. Six guys. They had about three beers between the six of them and two joints between the six of them. These are guys that used to polish off six packs a piece and ounces. And I said, what happened? And they looked just like me. And there's a classification. It talks about the heavy drinker. Given sufficient reason, change of environment. I'm too old for this. That's what they said. I'm married. I'm out of that. No, change environment, you know, sufficient enough reason. And they change. And the only reason I need to know about the heavy drinker is because if you're a guy like Ralph, you start thinking that you look like the heavy drinker. And my buddies that later on, about 27, 28 years old, that outgrew this foolishness I thought we were in, I thought I was going through a phase two. I thought I was going through a phase two, and I thought I would come up out of it. But what happened for me, looking back, I suffer from something they don't suffer from. It's something physically different about me. And there's something else, the mental obsession. And it says this would be academic and pointless if I never took the first one. But I take the first one. And I take the first one because Bob did a much better job of talking about that than I can talk about it. Because when I'm not drinking, I get restless, irritable, and discontent. When I'm not drinking, you know, I have a friend, I've heard a speaker say, when I'm not drinking, the world is gray. And when I start drinking, it turns technicolor. You know, I have another friend that says, you know, when I'm, and this is a woman, but I like the line, so I'm going to say it and I'm going to ascribe it to her because it don't fit me. She says when she's drinking, she gets wittier, tittier, and prettier. I said, oh, I like that. But it's a whole lot of way to describe it. But folk like us understand that there is something that happens when I'm drinking that when I'm not. See, I heard people say I couldn't stay sober for 30 minutes before I came. Well, that ain't my story. That was my problem. I could stay so. That was my problem. I couldn't stay loaded. If I could stay loaded, I wouldn't be here. But in the periods when I wasn't, I wanted to die. Because at the end, for me, my life consisted of getting it, doing it, coming down from it. 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 And I was drinking to stop from thinking where drinking had taken me. Cold place. Cold place to be. And I was in that jumping off place that Bob talked about. And I came around here, 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 and I faked it, and I faked it, and I couldn't never find myself. And I would get up, and I would admit that I'm an alcoholic, because I like, you guys let me talk if I admit I'm an alcoholic. And, okay, I like going places where people clap when I talk. So I'm an alcoholic, you know. And at about, 60 days, I had all the information because I had absorbed. I'm a good mimic and I'm a good chameleon. And I get up and say what you guys said. And I would keep getting loaded, keep getting loaded, keep getting loaded. And I didn't know that that step one is not the first step in recovery. We learned, after I was here a minute, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves, we were alcoholics. I had to fully concede to my innermost. This is the first step in recovery. An admission is out of my mouth. A concession is inside of me. And I'm going to make you like me, guy. That's who I am. I'm a fit. That's who I am. You know, I'm an image guy. I'm a style over substance guy. So I'll say what it is that's appropriate to say in the appropriate settings. I know how to say humility without feeling humble. Even to this day, I have to catch myself and check myself. I know how to say the right stuff. But I had to learn, we learned we had to fully concede. And that concession comes one way. Well, we're behind. You know, if you ain't got one, then you probably still got some more work to do. But I came in here and mine was nicely tenderized this last time. And I was able to listen long enough to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had I got a full understanding of my condition. That I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. The unmanageability was real apparent to me early on. And I looked at the external unmanageability. I didn't have a place to stay. You know, I'm a graduate of a major university in this country, and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage. I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. I was walking the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning with nowhere to go. I'd had no self-respect. I had no self-esteem. Nobody would trust me. I no longer had dreams and goals and ambitions. I did not have a pot to piss in and a window to throw it out of. I didn't know where my little girl was going to school, and I didn't know where my family was living. I had not been up at any to answer anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake up call to go to work in so long. I no longer thought I was employable. Life unmanageable. Yeah, I kind of could get with that one. And then a little bit later on, I understood the true definition of the unmanageability. I'm powerless over my emotional nature. You know, sometimes I feel like pulling the covers up over my head and just not getting up. Anybody ever feel like that some days? Just feel like I just don't want to get up out the bed. Feel like I can't make a living. Feel like I can't be of use to other people. Feel like I keep running in the walls in my relationship with folk. Feel like I keep running into the same things at work and folk keep on getting on my nerves and I can't seem to be a use of value to anybody. The true definition of life unmanageable and all those things were stretching out on the landscape. So, you know, first step is my problem. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity, and step two is the solution. And step two is also a conclusion I draw based on my experience. The best place to look is step two, and it's my favorite chapter in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes we call it the spiritual kindergarten, and that's We Agnostics. In the beginning of We Agnostics, there's a line in there there, and it goes, and in the first paragraph it talks something like this: if when you want to stop you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you cannot control the amount that you drink, then you are probably alcoholic. If when you want to stop you can't quit entirely, okay, I'm in that number, or if when you drink and you can't control the amount you take, who would want to? You know, I'm in that number. That idea in chapter 3 of control, the obsession is to control and enjoy his drinking. That was, never mind, check this out. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on control and enjoy anyway? If when you sincerely want to, you can't stop, or you can't control the amount, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, then you are probably suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. When I want to, can I stop? No. When I start, can I control how much I take? No. I believe I'm alcoholic? Yes. Do I believe I suffer from an illness? Wow. After going through the doctor's opinion, finding out that there's a physical component to this deal. I hear a lot of people talk about, I was alcoholic before I took a drink. Well, no, you might have been neurotic. You might have been crazy. You might have been a lot of stuff. But there's a physical component to alcoholism, and it requires alcohol to activate it. You know, so it's a lot of other stuff. But there's a physical component. There's something physically different about me. So I suffer from an illness. Do I believe I do? Yes, I do. Then I might be suffering from an illness. Here's the kicker: that only a spiritual experience will conquer. They hit me in that next one. We saw his face fall when we talked about that. To be doomed to die an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives. Why ain't that easy? Death. Not only death, alcoholic death. You know, slow, miserable, torturous death, lingering death, dead man walking death, people laughing at you, talking about you death, that kind of you don't want to go, you can't lay down at night, conscious come visiting death, that death, to be doomed to die like that. Okay, that's pretty drastic. Or to live life, oh yeah, I'll take life on a spiritual basis. Ooh. Dude, is there a door number 3 somewhere? Anybody else want a door number 3 when they first saw it? I wanted a door number 3. Why would that be? Why would I need a door number 3 when death is facing me? And I know it because of my experience. Just like Bob, I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I have been living it. I had come to believe that the party was over. I had come to believe that it's going to be nothing but getting it, doing it, coming down. I had come to believe in that. So how come when presented with the other alternative, it didn't seem attractive? Because living life on a spiritual basis, I thought, looked the same as dying the alcoholic death. Dray, grab, dull. At least I have the idea of recapturing the old day. So that idea, that's the crux of it. That's what it is we're talking about. That's what it is that we get embarking on the journey. That's the rest of this process. Do I believe I suffer from an illness that only I'm after a spiritual experience, but I don't know what it looked like? I don't know what a spiritual experience looked like. And I think I do. So this whole journey through the rest of this process, this whole deal, the entirety of the rest of what it is we do, because step 2 is the solution, 3 through 12, the 10-step program of action to get me to the solution, step 2 is not consummated at the second step. After step 9, it'll talk about, so by now we have been restored to sanity. So by now, sanity has returned. So it's some actions I do, and then I become the believe, and I get this belief that I'm looking for. So in step 2, this whole deal, this whole journey, this whole what it is I suffer from and what is it that's going to relieve me of it, I'm after a spiritual experience. That's what we're going to talk about the rest of the weekend. I'm after a spiritual experience because I suffer from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. How do I know only a spiritual experience will conquer it for a guy like me? Because I trial and error. I tried a material experience, didn't work. I tried an emotional experience, didn't work. I tried a financial experience, didn't work. I tried an intellectual experience, didn't work. I tried a physical experience. I'm going to work out. I'm going to get in shape. Didn't work. I tried a love experience, didn't work. Tried a money experience, didn't work. I tried any and every one of them. And every single one of them seemed like it ended up rooted in my problem. Seemed like it multiplied my problem. All the things I think of that I need to treat what it is that I'm treating are all the things that end up being the things I stress and trip about. Somebody in here is tripping about those things right now. I'm after a spiritual experience, but I don't know what it looked like. I don't know what it looked like. So in chapter 8, we agnostic, it talks about why it makes more sense to believe than not to believe. Why it makes more sense to believe than not to believe. It's a lot of stuff in there. Ralph, you know, and it gives me some starting points. And the first starting point is, do you know who has the hardest problem with this deal, the whole spiritual aspect of our program? Priests, ministers, nuns, professional religious people, because they handicap because they already know. And I'm not saying that because I'm a minister, priest, or any of that. I'm saying it because they've told me, you know. They're handicapped by what they already know. Clean slate is a whole lot better in this deal. But I'm handicapped. I grew up in the church. I grew up in the Baptist church. And I was raised in church. I went to Sunday school. I went to evening service. I went to BTU. I ate dinner at church. I said, when I turn 16 years old, you'll never have to worry about Ralph White darkening the doors of nobody else's church. Said it, did it, meant it. When I would sit up in the front, my mother, I don't know if anybody know about a Baptist church, or in a Southern Baptist church in Los Angeles. I wasn't in the South, but it's a bunch of Southern Baptists in Los Angeles. And that's the kind of church that I was raised in, you know, and every now and then they get the shouting, and I used to look at my mom and say, don't you embarrass me. You better not jump up. And that's the kind of guy I am. I'm the kid that on Easter Sunday could remember the verses, and on Christmas, and they put you up there and you do the reciting, and I knew all the verses, but none of them meant nothing to me. You know, they talked about a partner of the Red Sea. I'm a smart guy. That's a myth. I'm not here to knock anybody's religion. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about my thinking. And I examine my thinking, and I put it on display, and I shine a light on it, and that's how I got free from it. And at the beginning of the chapter, we agnostic, it says, Ralph, ask yourself, what do spiritual terms mean to you? What do they mean to you? So why would a guy like me go to this spiritual place when you already wrapped up in? Because we agnostics, agnosticism, and I didn't know I was agnostic, you know, and I had to have a definition of what that agnosticism is, and I don't use Webster all the time. I use working definitions for myself. You know, I knew I wasn't atheist. I got a partner that says I couldn't be atheist because it takes too much work to hold up your end of the argument. You gotta research why they ain't God, and you gotta be able to debate with the people who believe in God. No, I don't want to do the work, you know. I ain't atheist, you know. My agnosticism presents like this. I believe there's a God, but I don't believe he worked for me. My agnosticism presents like this. I believe that there's a God that works for you, but don't work for me. My agnosticism presents like this. I might believe that there's a God, but if you look at the way that I'm living, you put the way I'm living next to the person that don't believe, and you can't tell the difference between us. Believes there's a God, but acts and lives as if there ain't. You know, so I was full of agnosticism, you know, and so then, you know, but that statement, the statement that transformed Alcoholics Anonymous into a place where I could come to, the transformational statement of Alcoholics Anonymous that makes us different from other from any religious society. We are not anti-religious and we are not religious. You know, some folk get it confused and they go, no. Many of our members are very religious. As a society, we don't have a view on that one way or the other. And the thing that transformed it for me was the same statement that hit Bill. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? And for me, the reason I came in here, and in that chapter, it says, Ralph, let's do some building blocks. Let's do some building blocks for creating your own conception. Why do I need a conception of God? Why do I need one anyway? Talk about a second step experience. Why do I need one? I don't need a concept of Bob. I can look at him. You know, most of us can look at Bob, and there are some things we can agree on. He's a distinguished gentleman, you know, distinguished as opposed to old. He's got the white hair working, but... Handsome fellow, well dressed, Natalie attired, you know, and we can guess at his height, because we can see him. We can see him. I saw Mari. Mari, you look wonderful, dear. You know, she wears glasses. She's white hair. She's dressed well. She's nice. She's pretty. All that. We can see him. But what about this power? What about this God? I can't see him. Can't touch him. Can't feel him. Nobody in here can. And nobody comes with their own concept. Nobody enters the world with a concept of God. Most folk have a concept that's been imposed on them or that they've adopted by parents, peers, community, but some other outside influence. Didn't know I didn't have my own concept. Didn't ever think about it, never examined it, never thought about it. So then at the very beginning of this, so why would I want a concept of God anyway? I wanted one because I suffer from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. And even though at 16 years old I said that I'm through with this God idea. I came up in the era of the 60s and the 70s. God is an opiate of the people. I'd rather smoke mine. Thank you very much. You know, I came from that kind of era making, you know, just funny slogans and say I was defiant and I would, you know, and stood on my right to be. So what would change a guy like me? Alcohol. Well, we're behind. You ain't had to tell me more than once. Okay. You know, and in the chapter to the agnostic, he said, Ralph, here's the way that you start on this journey. Do I now ask myself one simple question? Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, not in the power, in the existence of a power greater than yourself? Check this out. I had already come to believe in a power bigger than me. We called it King Alcohol. I needed a power bigger than it. I had already come to believe in a power bigger than me. I needed a power bigger than it. First building block for me to get that second step experience. Because I suffer from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe? You know, and from that beginning, there's a part in there, and I used to see my grandfather, and I say, yeah, granddaddy, you believe that. You've been believing a long time. God can smile on you and you can do this, but what about me? And I thought, and I love, read chapter to the agnostic. Because it knocks down all the objections. It'll knock them down. Ralph, from that very beginning, you ain't got to have a full-fledged idea. You ain't got to already know God in order to make use of God. You know, you might be sitting out there thinking to yourself, yeah, this guy standing up in the front, dressed pretty nice. He's been sober 24 years. He's been on the path. And if you knew, you might be thinking, he talking about God because, you know, that's easy for him. It's comfortable for him. You know, you heard Bob up here. You know, yeah, come. But what about me? What about me? I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling that. Check this out. I did not come up in here walking toward the light. I came up in here running from the fire. And if your behind is on fire, that's a very good starting place for you too. So making use of spiritual principles don't take a hold, you know, the most freeing line in the book. God don't make too hard of terms with those who seek him. Don't make too hard of terms with those who seek him. Ask yourself, what do spiritual terms mean to you? And I started looking at my prejudices. And I started looking at them. You know, I used to look at my mom, church lady, for real. My grandfather and my grandmother, when they were both alive, my grandmother and grandfather were married 54 years. I never saw my grandfather not spend a night in the house. Now, you would think I found that admirable. I used to look at that and be like, dude, you going to be with the same woman in the same house every night? And I would think, oh, what an order. I can't, you know, I did not. See, my grandparents, and they came out, they came to California from the South. My granddaddy was a laborer, and he came out and they bought their own home, and they stayed in their own home. And as much as I talked about my grandfather, I would say to myself, I make more in a year than my granddaddy probably made in half his career. And I would say stuff like when I was at my height. And it dawned on me. My grandfather never asked me for bail money. Oh, okay. I'm the one, big shot, big guy, went to school. Yeah, y'all need church because you know you guys aren't slick enough. You're not sharp enough. You don't know enough. Granddaddy, grandmama, mama, you don't. My mom never asked me to buy her shoes. Never asked me to buy, you know, and I looked at that. And there's a part in the book that talks about we saw where religious people were right. We were quick to see where they were right. Because my deal is I'm quick to see where the preacher is sleeping with one of the sisters in the front row. I'm quick to see where the preacher is sleeping with one of the sisters singing in the choir. I'm quick to see where one of the deacons is out and I see him at the club on Saturday night, toe up just like me. I'm quick to see that kind of stuff. But it started talking about we were able to see where religious people were exhibiting a degree of happiness, usefulness, and stability and stability. My grandparents, LU63992. For some of you guys that's old, you might recognize that as a phone number when phone numbers had letter prefixes. 5663992. I can't tell you how many phones I've had. That's my grandparents' phone number when they were alive. They had it my whole life. They had one phone number. They had one address. I had four phone numbers in a year before. You know, they were exhibiting a degree of stability, usefulness. So I started looking at that, and I started seeing, well, wait a minute. There might be something to this whole religious/God idea. And I started growing it. I started growing my experience. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Might be obscured by calamity, stuff that's going on in the world, the economy, my money gone, oh, ain't no God nowhere and all this stuff. How am I going to find God with all the stuff, the tsunami in Japan? I'm like that guy. I look at all of that stuff and make it bigger than I am. I ain't trying to do nothing about it, but I'm looking at it. Calamity, pomp, who I think I am, you know, who I think I need to be, the puffing up and the rest. Worship of other things, women, money, prestige, you know, that thing. It might be covered up with that. But deep down in every man, so I embarked on that journey of uncovering, discovering, and discarding what blocks me. And then when I come out of that second step, when you finish reading the 12 steps in the book, it says, being convinced, the steps 1 and 2, which tell me those are conclusions I draw based on my experience. I'm convinced that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. What convinces me? Taking a real good hard look at my own experience. That's the convincer. Not nobody else, not nothing else that's going on in here. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's an exercise in honesty, the most honesty I can muster at the time. Yeah, alcohol told me a new one and it ain't no comeback from it. And my life is off the rails. And the other conclusion I drew, I couldn't stop me. I tried. I made agreements with my brother. I made pacts with my brother. We held hands with my mother. We held hands in a circle. I looked at my wife and I looked at that 2-year-old daughter, and I would even try a resentment. How dare they? I came home one Sunday after being out all weekend, and when I got stuck the key in the door, my wife was in the house with my mom, and I could not believe she had told my mom. Like my mom didn't know. You know, by now we close to the end. We close to me getting put out the house. I'm regularly not showing up. My mom is regularly having to bail us out. You know, my mom is regularly here, probably hearing my wife cry. All, and she had told my mom, I came in the house, my mom is standing there, my wife, and they trying to do an intervention. Let's go talk to the preacher. And I couldn't believe it, but I went and talked to the preacher because I wanted to get back in the house this weekend, right? So we're talking to the preacher, and the preacher told my wife, you're going to have to leave him. And I was like, how dare he? Because I'm trying to give the right answers, but it's clear. It's clear I'm running game and I'm insincere, you know, and it was real clear to everybody what was going on with me at the time, you know. So I've drawn this conclusion. I can't stop me. And I said to myself, can't believe they went to the preacher on me. Can't believe she went to my wife on me. I'm not going to drink for the next month or 3 months. And then I'm going to come back. I'll show them the kid is back. Won't nobody be able to say nothing to me, you know. And I'm full of resentment, and I'm thinking that'll do it. And that night, gone again. Couldn't pull it off one night. I couldn't stop me. You couldn't stop me. Judge couldn't stop me. Job couldn't stop me. If it ain't a power bigger than me, I'm in big trouble. Took step 2 out of what do I have to lose? Last house. Being convinced. We were now at step 3, which is that we turn our will, which is my thinking and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood it. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Flip the page over a little bit and it says, this is the how and the why of it. This is what we mean by that, and this is what we do. We have to stop playing God. Not because there should be no God before me, you know, not the biblical stuff they say. Again, I'm not knocking it. Practical God. We had to stop playing God. Why? Didn't work. I like that. I like it short, sweet, to the point. Not that it ain't the right thing to do. Not that it ain't virtuous to do. Not that God going to get mad at you if you keep doing it. Not that God is going to do anything. No, it don't work. Don't work. Wow, what a revelation. And the simplicity of this program. How do I know it doesn't work? Look at my experience. How do I know when I'm playing God? Till I get into the process of recovery, should I know? Because that's all I am doing. How do I know when I'm not? You know, they have a thing that, you know, and I like this one. I heard somebody once say, you know the difference between you and God? God ain't never woke up and thought he was you. The first requirement is we be convinced that any life run on self-will can be a success. Check this out. Anybody in here successfully running your life, don't get on the spiritual path. Keep running. Anybody in here that's successfully running your life, sitting here for the rest of the weekend with the rest of us, audit the course. Don't trip. Don't do none of the actions. You don't have to. But if you're like me, and your life is a constant series of train wrecks, if you like me, and looking back on your experience, you see that every single time you do what it is that you do, you know, you always in collision with something or somebody. I love the description of, you know, playing God that's in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he talks about, being the actor. When I was a kid, I used to walk around my elementary school, real story, true story, and I used to walk upright and I'd square my shoulders, and sometimes I might even talk to myself a little bit in a particular voice, because I just knew I was on candy camera. I knew it. I'd walk rehearsing for when candy camera would catch me. You know, and so I, you know, do a little, you know, and then my name, get my little pimple. You know, I just knew I was, and talk about selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of what it is that I suffer from. I have so much fun, you know, when I get to talking about this. I didn't know the time was gone. I'm going to rush through this third step, because one of the things, you know, that third step, selfishness and self-centeredness, the bondage, that's the whole deal. What are you talking about, Ralph, when you talk about, you know, suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer? What does the spiritual experience look like? How do I grasp that? How do I develop that? Because it's talking about grasping and developing a manner of living. We're going to talk about that through the rest of the weekend. And there's a process that if I submit, the third step is a promise to submit to the process will turn over my will and my life. There are a series of actions that I can take, and if I take them in the right spirit, see, because I can do this in one or two ways, because the whole deal is reducing ego, a whole deal, ego reduction, whole deal, grow God, shrink Ralph. Sum it up, grow God, shrink Ralph. Rest of the weekend, grow God, shrink Ralph. That's the essence of the spiritual experience. Some folks be talking, I had a sponsee that was telling me the other day, we were meeting, and she said, Ralph, you know, I just think that there's more to me than this. I said, no, there's too much to me already. I need less to me and more to God. I need less to me and more to God. And the whole essence of this, so when I get on my knees every year with a group of people, because that's what I do, I get on my knees every year because I'm convinced that my life run on my will can hardly be a success, and I need new management. And the thing about it, I used to worry, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, what if he put me in a white polyester suit and have me preaching on the corner? I had a partner that said, when you came up in here, that would have been a vast improvement. I don't know why you tripping, you know. That would have been preferable to the way you came in here. Why are you tripping? You know, and it came to me. Turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What does that mean? I'm going to turn my wife, my life, I'm going to turn my money over to the care of Polly. Polly handles money better than me. She's my broker. She handles my money. She's my broker. Polly, grow my money. Whose money is it? It's my money. She's growing it. It's in her care. It's my life. I'm in God's care. He ain't going to make me Bob Darrell. He ain't going to make me Polly. He ain't going to make me. He's going to make me me. He's going to make me the best me that I can be. When you get on this journey of discovery, he's going to strip what it is that ain't me away from it, and he's going to do what it is for me. Bob was talking about the difference between relief and freedom. If you want everything that this program has to offer, if you want everything on the table, if you want to be the most and the best that there is inside, you grow God, shrink me. He ain't going to turn me into something other than me. How many parents we got? We got a bunch of parents in here. You got three or four kids. You ain't going to try to make each one be who they are. You're going to encourage them to be who they want to be. When I look at God and this, my concept, when I'm growing my God concept, because I ask myself, what do they mean to me? What do spiritual terms mean to me? Sometimes I have to put it in terms that's at least comprehensible to me, even though I know it don't touch what God is. If God is small enough for me to understand, he ain't big enough for me to trust. I don't try to understand him. But still, I make some stuff comprehensible to me. And I have two daughters. And one of them is, just took the state bar exam. She's getting ready to be a lawyer. And one of them wants to be an actress. And I don't want rain to be river, and I don't want river to be rain. I try to bring out the best in my girls, and I want for them what they want for them. And I believe my daddy wants for me what I want for me. You know, and he's going to cultivate, and he's going to do, and he's going to. And so when I get on my knees, but sometimes that changes. And I'm open for the changes. I'm open for the path that he puts me on. I get on my knees with some people and I say, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. And I did that with 1 year of recovery, and I couldn't believe it. Because with 1 year, I was still tore up. I was still destitute. I was still growing. I was still a lot of things. If I walked up to any woman in here and say, God, and I say, baby, I offer myself to you, you would have been like, keep it moving, dude. You know. But when I did this, God, I offer myself to you, he took me. Took me. Imagine that. He took you to. He took me. That still blows me away sometimes. And he worked with me. And he's done some things with me. And he's done some things in a strange way. He's done the most with me in the areas that I think of as my adversities. He's taken me places I never thought I'd go. He's worked with me in the dark places. And he's fit me and made me somebody who's got something to offer to somebody else. Highest calling in Alcoholics Anonymous. First phase of development, help me. Almost all of us come in here on that one. Second phase, give me. Grant me peace as I go from here. Grant me the serenity. Third phase, the highest call in alcohol, use me. Use me. Use me. I'm Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic.